Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show where we talk about a subject that affects you each and every day, the United States Constitution. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from WETS, HD1, and FM in Johnson City, Tennessee. You know, one of my fondest childhood memories is of summer vacation, and specifically summer trips. Mom and Dad would pull out the old Pontiac station wagon, and they'd throw the three of us kids in the back, and we'd wrestle around there, no seat belts, of course, in those days, until oftentimes Mom and Dad would pull up in front of this or that historic site, Civil War, battlefields, museums, or historical houses. Historical houses that were owned by, oh, maybe even framers of the Constitution or founders of the nation. I remember fondly going to Monticello, Thomas Jefferson's beautiful home near Charlottesville, Virginia. I remember going to Williamsburg that has lots of historical homes in it. I remember a visit to Mount Vernon, George Washington's home on the banks of the Potomac. They were all wonderful. But one place we never went was the home of the father of our Constitution, James Madison. Now, I knew somehow vaguely that his home still existed and that it was called Montpelier. But somehow, I'd never gone until one day, just a few years back, I found myself near Orange, Virginia, just north of Charlottesville, and I drove in. And I said, finally, I've made it here to Montpelier. I wonder why I've never been here before. Well, there was a good reason. It's because when I was a kid, back in the 1960s, Montpelier was privately owned. It wasn't open for tours. In fact, it's only been owned by its current owner, the National Trust for Historic Preservation, since the 1980s. And it's only been in the last 10 years, since roughly 2000, that the renovations of this estate to bring it back to the way it was when James Madison owned it have occurred. But I'm very happy to report that those renovations are nearly complete, that the Montpelier Foundation and the National Trust for Historic Preservation are welcoming visitors, and I'm very pleased to say that I recently went there and spoke with several people. Now, the first of those people I spoke to is a fellow by the name of Tom Chapman. He has the interesting title of Executive Projects Manager, and that means that anytime a new project needs to get done, well, they call Tom.
My name is Tom Chapman. I work here as the Executive Projects Manager currently for James Madison's Montpelier. I've been involved with the property going back to 1998.
1998, wow.
Started here in the archaeology department working here. Well, in 98, I had just gotten out of high school or college. Mm-hmm. And wasn't sure exactly what I wanted to do, and knew I was interested in history and archaeology, and a professor at James Madison University where I went to school.
How appropriate.
Yes, somewhat. recommended that I combine the two into a historical archaeology focus. And said James Madison's Montpelier would be the great place to kind of cut my teeth. So,
now, when most people think of archaeology, they think of maybe dinosaurs or maybe a little bit more recently ancient Greece or Rome or something, but it's not limited to that, is it?
No, I mean, we don't have centuries of history here. It's two centuries, maybe three in certain areas of the coast, but here at Montpelier it goes back to 1723 when James Madison's grandfather first patented and brought his family out here into the Piedmont. So for us, that's the history of what we're interested in. The prehistoric side goes back a number of centuries longer than that.
Right.
But in terms of modern history, I guess you can say. So we don't have a Pompeii or, you know, a Roman villa out here. But archaeology does provide a pretty significant resource, particularly on the plantation and understanding James Madison's use of the land, his slave population and their work here, an illiterate group of folks such as the slaves, and then unfortunately a lot of Madison's plantation documents, the day-to-day activities, the ledgers, the account books, those things haven't survived. So archaeology fills a major role in terms of providing that information so that we can interpret that to our visiting public.
Well, let me just back up here. Now, of course, the mansion still exists. The mansion is sitting there. You can look at it when you drive in. And that might give the false impression then that everything is still preserved as well as the mansion itself. But I take it from what you've just been saying that it's not, that there are things that have been obscured by time, and that's what you're looking for?
Exactly. Of the buildings, we have a total of, from my project management standpoint there, we have a total of 140 buildings on the property.
There are 100, how many acres is this?
We say it's a little under 2,650.
Wow. How does that compare with the original size of the estate?
The original size of the estate was about that, and then grew over time from his grandfather to his father, so that by the time Madison took ownership in 1801, it's roughly about 5,000 acres.
So you got roughly half the acreage that Madison had when he was here.
Of the property that Montpelier manages now, it's something along the lines of 1,800 acres of the 2,600 or 2,700 is Madison land.
Mm-hmm.
The other land, the other next longest tenured landowner was the DuPont family, mm-hmm. from 1901 to 1984-85. And they acquired from the original 1,000 acres, a little over 1,000 acres they purchased, they acquired additional land to bring the property up to about 3,000 acres during their tenure.
Uh-huh.
And they were kind of early, the way they thought about it, they were kind of building a buffer around the core. So they were acquiring land in some cases that Madison family never owned.
I see.
But now that we have the acreage that we do, if we ever do see any kind of suburban encroachment out here, we would be a nice little park within a park,
right,
so to speak.
And obviously, this is on the radio, and people can't see it, and I hope people will come see it. But until they have that opportunity, I will say that it's a lovely setting. This is some of the most wonderful, beautiful landscape that one can have. It's lovely, rolling, wooded hillsides and all the rest of it. And when you come in from the main road, and you come around that first corner after the bridge over the railroad tracks, you see the mansion ahead of you,
mm-hmm.
and it's very, very well preserved. It looks very much like it might have looked in 1801,
mm-hmm.
one imagines at least.
Mm-hmm.
But you say that in this roughly 1,800 or so acres that you have here, you have how many buildings?
Right now we manage about 2,700 acres, and in that is about 140 buildings, of which about half are major buildings, residences, large barns. Of those buildings, only two date back to Madison period, that being the mansion and then his garden temple, what is our kind of iconic symbol.
Oh, right, yeah,
that we use
every place
our,
you look here.
Our logo, so to speak.
Right.
So those are the only two buildings that are standing. There would have been numerous outbuildings, slave cabins, smokehouses, well houses, barns, I mean, all these types of different buildings that now, through archaeology, we're uncovering. When I started here in 98, I was working on the Mount Pleasant site, which is located over next to the Madison Family Cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the original house that was built on the property by the president's grandfather.
That's right. In fact, that's what he called this, was Mount Pleasant, right?
He referred to it as Mount Pleasant.
Mm-hmm.
There's some thought that Montpelier is kind of the French version of Mount Pleasant.
Oh, really? So, I didn't know that.
Montpelier basically kind of, it's referring to a French town in the southern part of France called Montpelier,
mm-hmm.
Known for being a high, salubrious place, had an academic side to it, had a university there.
Huh.
But if you just take it for face value, it basically means a high, pleasant place.
Uh-huh.
So Mount Pleasant or Montpelier. We don't know exactly if it was Madison's taking the French version of an anglicized
name.
Well,
I have to mention something now. As well preserved as Montpelier is, and as beautiful as the setting is, obviously from the time of Madison's death and remind me, that was in 1836. Then there were several other owners in the 19th century.
Yes.
And then the DuPonts bought it in 1901, and they had it right up until 1985. And here's a bit of trivia. It was then transferred to the Montpelier Trust, or the Montpelier Foundation, right?
Marion DuPont Scott, who was the last of the DuPonts who lived here, had life estate in the property. Mm-hmm. Her father had given her life estate. She had a brother who had passed away prior to her, and he had what were Marion's nieces and nephews. Mm-hmm. So the land would have transferred to the nieces and nephews. But Mrs. Scott, in her will, very strongly suggested that her nieces and nephews give the property and the land to the National Trust for Historic Preservation. And after the estate was settled, that's how it came into the possession of the National Trust. So they continued to be the stewards of the land and the buildings. We have a co-stewardship agreement between the Montpelier Foundation that I work for and the National Trust. So we manage the day-to-day activities, the financial issues, and those things to keep the doors open and keep all the buildings standing.
Okay, and that's not the trivial part. That's a very important part. The trivial part is that I personally came to visit here right after that transfer took place, or right around the time it did. And when I first set eyes upon Montpelier, it was being renovated. And a big question was how much of the DuPont family's alterations to keep and how much of them not to keep. And I sense, without knowing, that for the most part in the mansion, it's all about James Madison and Dolly Madison, but that many of the outbuildings that the DuPonts put here and the horse racetrack and things of that sort, those have been preserved. Is that a fairly accurate statement?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
The restoration of the mansion, which we completed in 2007-2008, really brought the house that James and Dolly knew back into existence. It took off all of the DuPont additions to the mansion itself. But in terms of the historic property, it's a living entity. You can't really look at this property and think, you know, I'm in Williamsburg in 1783 and everyone's doing 1783. It's an organic thing that has grown over time. So what we are stewards of is a large amount of acreage that has primarily a DuPont stable complex agricultural estate that we are utilizing. We're now sitting in a building that used to be a brick stable that housed William DuPont's percherons and carriages.
That's what I thought it was. We're in Lewis Hall, which is now the location of the Center for the Constitution. But I was wondering, when I drove up to it, I was thinking to myself, that looks like some sort of stable. And it was the DuPonts built it.
It was a brick stable that was constructed by William DuPont, one of the first buildings he built on the property. And with our work with the National Trust and now with the Montpelier Foundation, we've been very focused on trying to preserve the buildings that we have. But we can't find a use for it as a stable for any horses or carriages. But what we can find a reuse for is for classrooms and dining space and offices like we do now.
So. And it's been beautifully restored and refurbished and renovated. It's a lovely facility and very high tech, too. I see the cameras and everything around the classroom here. Okay, so you've got James Madison's Montpelier, the old mansion at the center of all of this. And you've got these other buildings that you're repurposing or preserving or in their own way, and hundreds of them, so that it's a big, big project. But to get to back to the mansion area, apparently there are then some other, if not the outbuildings themselves, there are some remnants of them, some foundations and things. Is that what you're digging up then? Is the stuff from Madison's era?
Yes.
So what sort of stuff have you dug up since 1998?
Well, I started here working on the Mount Pleasant site, and then moved over to the family cemetery prior to 2001. 2001 was the 250th anniversary of the president's birthday. And we had looked at the cemetery as a renovation project. The brick wall around it had started to fail. Some of the monuments had been not maintained over the years. So we did some archaeology there prior to the renovation work just to make sure that we weren't going to disturb anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So that was another project that I worked on. I actually turned that into my master's thesis and then came back to work at Montpelier.
So you really are the guy who knows where the bodies are buried.
I know where a lot of them are.
All right.
And there's more than meets the eye out there in terms of the cemetery. There's approximately 40 gravestones, but probably upwards of 100 total burials.
Wow. That's the Madison's family, that James and Dolly themselves, right?
Mm-hmm.
And who else?
It's basically all the Madison family, starting with the president's grandfather, who was the inception of the cemetery, I guess you could say, in 1732 when he passed away. And then the president's father was one of three children. Some of his sister's family may be buried there in unmarked graves. But then James Madison Sr., the president's father, and his wife Nellie had a total of 12 children, of which six or seven of them lived to adulthood and had children of their own, and there are still descendants of those families. So
there are still Madison descendants around.
Mm-hmm.
Are any of them in the immediate vicinity or involved with us? Or?
Yes, mm-hmm. There's a few that are still living in the area or have actually moved back to the area, kind of coming back to their roots.
Mm-hmm.
But they're spread across the world. The Madison Family Association was created about the same time that the property was open to the public, and they have grown as a genealogical and family association to they have their biannual reunions here at Montpelier and bring folks
That must be fun.
Mm-hmm. So yes, there's actually they started a DNA project to trace the family back to European origins, which they've been pretty successful in doing so. And they got a lot of different things going on that end. And then with what we're doing with the mansion, the restoration of the mansion architecturally was one step in the process, and now we're trying to bring the stuff that James and Dolly would have had in the mansion back.
The actual physical objects or replicas or contemporary pieces or what?
As far as possible, trying to get the actual historical objects or at least understand where they are so that we can reproduce them and bring something back, whether it's the original or if it's a replica of that, to put it back in the mansion where it used to be.
Has that been clear always as to what the use of each room was originally or what it looked like, or have you had to do a little bit of educated guessing?
A mixture of all. Mm-hmm. Some of the rooms are very well documented because of visitors' accounts, and those were the more public spaces, the drawing room, the dining room, Madison's study on the first floor. Some of the other rooms that were less publicly accessible during their lifetime, we don't really know. We can deduce from some of the documents.
That's one thing James Madison did not have to deal with, was those wretched devices we call cell phones. I detest them. And it's not simply because yours rang. I detest them, just generally speaking, on general principles. But anyway.
It is off now.
No problem.
We can deduce from the documentary evidence certain uses, room uses, but like with anyone's house, if you live in it for a number of years and you have kids and then they go to college and then a bedroom becomes a den or a den becomes a bedroom, it's an organic type of construction to it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Were you able to go down and like dig beneath the recent coats of paint and find what was mm-hmm. there before? Is that the sort of thing that was done?
The restoration of the house was kind of like an archaeology project, except digging into the walls and the ceilings and the floors.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily enough, the DuPonts, in putting on their additions when they tore out some of the Madison part of it, reused certain parts. So we would find pieces of stairs utilized in walls of the DuPont addition, and so it was a massive kind of restoration attempt to bring all that information together. If you ever have the good fortune of talking to John Jeans, who was our director of restoration here, mm-hmm. he can tell you many more stories than I can about that.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, and we're on a visit to James Madison's Montpelier, the home of the father of our Constitution. We've been talking to Tom Chapman about all the special projects that he works on. After the break, we'll come back and talk to the fellow who's in charge of the ongoing renovation of James Madison's mansion at Montpelier. His name is John Jeans. To everything turn, there is a season your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. I'm on a visit to Montpelier, James Madison's Montpelier, and next I'm going to be talking to John Jeans.
I am Director of Facilities and Restoration here at James Madison's Montpelier. I've been involved in the restoration process here since 2001, October of 2001, and during the initial phases, we had a feasibility study which lasted from October 01 until about November 03. And during that time frame, we studied the home of James Madison and all the aggregate additions and alterations that had occurred from about 1765 until 2000.
I imagine there were quite a few during that time.
A considerable number. In fact, in order to document all the changes and so forth, we created a document that was about 2,300 pages long, 15 volumes.
And 15? Good grief.
So it was quite comprehensive. And really what we had to deal with was the building as James Madison knew it. He moved in to the home that his father built here, a brick Georgian 4x4, sometime around 1765.
And that means four rooms over four rooms, or just a big rectangle?
Four rooms and a main hall in between. And then as James Madison got older, there were alterations that he was in charge of. In 1797, he and Dolly added a 30-foot addition to the north, and along with that, they added the grand portico, which you see in the front of the house. And then when he rose to presidency in 1809, he added the two wings on the north and the south. He added the colonnade on the east facade of the house, and also the two master builders who had completed their work for Thomas Jefferson at Monticello came down on a wagon in 1809, James Dinsmore and John Nielsen, along with Hugh Chisholm Mason. Mm-hmm. And they worked for the next 3 years transforming the house into what Madison envisioned and what you see now. And a lot of this was done while Madison was constantly in communication with Jefferson on various ideas that together they seem to have loaned each other various thoughts, and many of which Madison followed through with, and some he didn't. But items that you would recognize that have Jefferson's stamp would be the Chinese rails on the wings, the terraced roofs, mm-hmm. these flat, reasonably flat roofs that allow you to walk out and enjoy the space as a living space, mm-hmm. and have a quite wonderful view of the Blue Ridge Mountains. Another item would be the Venetian doorway. There was a drawing that left Montpelier sometime around 1807. It had a free franc stamp on it. It was sent to the War Department in Washington. where Madison received it and studied it and sent it on to Jefferson, then president at Monticello. And there are various computations and writings on the back of this in Jefferson's hand, you know, showing quite definitely that there was a conversation between the two of them on how this house should look.
So sort of a joint design?
Well, we know that Madison thought highly of Mr. Jefferson's skills as an architect and as a politician as well. And, and they worked together in both fields.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting, a very close collaboration. Now, we're standing here in a room on which end of the building are we now?
This is the south wing.
The south wing. Okay, well, why don't you tell us about what's in this room?
Well, this particular room would have been a room that was dedicated to James's mother, Nellie. And so he created this space for her. His father had passed away in 1801, and by 1809 through 1812, that's when this particular building campaign occurred.
This was the mother-in-law wing, or mother wing, from James's perspective. But from Dolly's perspective, this is someplace to put the mother-in-law.
Yes, and they got along very well, as as that goes. There is an interesting story, however, humorous, that in the three building campaigns, first the Georgian 4x4, then the second one, where the 30-foot addition was put onto the north, there was no communication between this addition for James and Dolly and his mother and father, who were still on the south side of the house.
There were no doors between them.
They had to step out onto the portico through the flanking doors. So it was, you know, truly a separation there.
Right.
And probably assisted greatly in their
good relations.
Yeah.
I bet there were. Yeah, I bet there were.
But in general, in both Dolly's and Nellie's memoirs and so forth, there are always, they speak very highly of each other.
It kind of funny. It reminds me of a story I recently read about another president, President Franklin Roosevelt, when he and his new bride, Eleanor, came back to New York City from their grand tour of Europe. Sarah Roosevelt, Franklin's mother, gave them a present, and that was a townhouse in New York City. And lo and behold, it was directly adjacent to hers. And on all three stories, there were connecting doors, which Sarah made liberal use of. So I can, that was just the opposite of what the Madisons did. I think maybe the Madisons had the better idea.
Well, that we do know that on the second floor, there was communication to the old library. Madison made, James Madison made sure that he had access to his father's library and his own joint library at the time.
Very nice. Okay, so this was Grandma or Mom Madison's room over here. Anything else you want to tell us about this room before we move on?
Well, I think, you know, for the purpose of the discussion, considering the type of work that had to occur in order to restore the home, it's worthy to consider that this space in which we're standing, as well as the entire house, was nested in additions that were placed in 1901. The original house, once the three building campaigns were completed that occurred in Madison's lifetime, once they were done, the total square footage was somewhere around 12,500 square feet. In 1901, William DuPont had purchased the property, and he expanded the house to about 36,000 square feet. So that meant taking this single-story wing in which we're standing and raising it to a second story, and then tying in the roof lines above that with a living space, as well as adding to the east side of the lawn significant square footage.
Wait a second now. Hold on. DuPont tripled the size of this house.
That's correct.
And all of that has been removed.
That is correct.
So you took, when the Montpelier Foundation took control of this property, they removed two-thirds of the existing structure at that time.
That is correct.
That is remarkable. That was quite a project, wasn't it?
It was very time-consuming, and it had to be extremely an extremely careful process, in particular because the DuPonts, I'm not certain that that in this period, 1901, conservation of elements was high on priorities, but it certainly was for the DuPonts, in my estimation, when you consider that their 10 window boxes that were removed where the additions would be attached to the house, and those window boxes were simply moved out into the new addition. So original Madison fabric was conserved and reused as opposed to being discarded. And I bring out a point in contrast to that. In the Greek Revival period, sometime around the 1850s, late 1840s, there were alterations done by another post-Madison owner in either the Carson period or the Thornton period, in which the fenestration, the windows on the south side, mm-hmm. and in this room you can view these two sash,
right.
they had been removed mm-hmm. and infilled with brick, and we have no idea where those window boxes went. So part of our restoration process meant to recreate those based on the models we had elsewhere.
So those two windows on either side of the fireplace on the far south end of the house, those are educated guesses as to where they should be?
Much more than an educated guess. We mm-hmm. had such clear definition. Once plaster was removed from the interior, stucco was removed on the exterior, we had the old paint lines on the brick.
Oh, okay, good. Great.
For where the windows had been, and the interior brickwork was largely intact. It was simply infilled. So we knew pretty much exactly what the windows and so forth were based on the physical evidence as well as in the actual third period, building period, where Dinsmore and Nielsen did all the work. They Dinsmore had left a very thorough account and reckoning of all of the trim that had been added to the house, the linear footage of everything, and an explanation of every piece that he had added. And of course, this wing was built to purpose at that time. This was newly constructed.
Okay, so between the archaeological evidence, architectural evidence, I guess, and the accounts of the contemporaneous accounts of the prior property owners, you could pretty much figure out where these things should go then.
Yes, to the eighth of an inch, really.
That's tremendous. No, and that's nice to know that they're in the authentic place. By sheerest coincidence, I happen to have toured this property shortly after it was acquired by the Montpelier Foundation, and I actually saw it in its in a transition between the DuPonts and here. And this was the so-called Red Room, right, where the DuPonts had riding trophies and things of this. Oops, I'm knocking my briefcase over. They had various riding trophies and other items from their horsemanship activities, right?
Yes, more specifically, Marion DuPont Scott, when she took over the property, altered this space to accommodate her needs, and that would be the Red Room, the Art Deco Room, which is,
right.
was a, quite a an extraordinary space. And for our visitors, we have taken all of those elements, very carefully removed them, numbered, documented, and they were in storage while the restoration was going on. And when we built our new visitor center, which is not too far off. You can't see it from here, but it's, mm-hmm. it's over this next hill, nested nicely behind the slope there. Mm-hmm. We created one space. Our architect created a sort of a vanilla envelope in which we then brought all of those items and rebuilt that room.
Oh, well, I'm looking forward to seeing that then, because it was what I was going to comment was that it was utterly different.
Yes.
When I walked in here, when however many years ago it was I was here, it looked entirely different. It's hard to even reconcile how it looks now with how it where it did then. So I can appreciate personally what an enormous undertaking this was and how much care you must have had to use just to get down to where you could figure out where windows go or what sort of paint color you'd need on the walls, that sort of thing. So this was just a massive undertaking, wasn't it?
It certainly was. One of the items that I was going to mention was that in the, we call it deconstruction instead of a demolition, because we very carefully removed every element, which goes back to what I had mentioned about the DuPonts reusing items. And in fact, if a partition or a door or something like that was deemed necessary to move from one space, they would generally reincorporate it somewhere else in the house. And that went for framing materials as well, both what you would see and what was behind the scenes. And so they turned out to be, those elements turned out to be hugely informative as we deconstructed. In our feasibility study, we found out a tremendous amount about the house. In fact, we found out enough to have the support of our peer groups in the preservation world to sort of acknowledge that we had done due diligence and we had sufficient information to do a very accurate restoration, and therefore they put their stamp of approval on it.
And that's very important because you can really screw up a restoration, can't you?
Well,
you can come in with the best of intentions, but just destroy all sorts of history as you go forward if you're not careful.
Yeah, and there's so many things that are variables here. You know, just where you are as far as technology goes. You're at a certain point in with your technological developments that allow you to do a certain amount of non-invasive study on a building. But 10 years from now, 20 years from now, there are going to be even better tools. So our, MO here is that you want to try and extract from the house all of the information that it provides without losing any of it. So we, as we dismantled the additional 24,000 square feet of home, we could identify reused material, and that immediately went to a location where we could study it. And once, we may have three boards in one room and six boards from another and seven from another, totally different areas of the house. And when they're put together, they, for example, this happened in two cases, the cellar stair, which leads down off to our left, this hallway, there's paneling, gorgeous, it's five-quarter, heart pine, beaded paneling, tongue and groove. And we located slivers of that that had been cut down to use as furring strips on the masonry walls on which to nail the lath and then on which to put the plaster at a later date. And so as those were put together and matched, there were various paint ghosts. Mm-hmm. It turned out we had the rise and the run of the cellar stair. That information was gone. It would not
have been available. Wait a minute. So you reconstructed paneling.
Yes.
And on the reconstructed paneling, there were remnants of old paint traces.
Exactly.
That then outlined the cross-section of the staircase. And from that, you were able to reconstruct the staircase.
Exactly.
that's a great line of deduction. It really is.
And the other part of that, because it was, these are 17-inch panel pieces. They're tongue and groove pieces that were ripped down to about 2.5 to 3-inch widths. So we couldn't be expected necessarily to put them back together, but we could get like materials. We could reconstruct that material to match identically. The other information that we got was the paint history, which told us every layer of paint that ever went on, so we knew the original colors.
Mm-hmm.
So within the house, anywhere you see woodwork and it has paint on it, we have been able to analyze. Our paint analyst, Susan Buck from Colonial Williamsburg, has very carefully addressed what the chemistry of the paint is, the color, and what formulas we require to recreate those colors.
So you reconstituted the actual formulas for the paint?
That's correct.
So this isn't Glidden or something that looks like it. It's the actual original paint reconstituted.
It is the formulas reconstituted.
Right, right.
We made everything as it would have been in the period, with one exception. We don't want to add lead to our paint.
Oh, good point.
We use titanium dioxide as a vehicle rather than the lead. And so, it bears some difference based on the health of our visitors.
Well, that's just a safety issue. Sure, you have to do that. Okay, well, that's great. Well, the Madisons had very good taste. I can tell just by looking around here. If these were the original colors they picked, they're lovely. We're in a room that's, I guess, primarily a white or an off-white. With what color would you say the accents are?
Well, it's sort of a little bit of an olive color on the trim.
But a very light olive color, yeah.
Very light. And
almost a tan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the baseboards are a gray. They would, you know, they were often called washboards because you may be mopping right up to them.
Mm-hmm.
And the gray color was to diminish that, you know, any of the discoloration you might have from a wet mop hitting after cleaning a floor. And in this section of the house, in the older section of the house, the plaster is all a lime-based plaster. So we went back with a lime-based plaster, and it had a lime wash finish on it. Whereas if you go into the north side of the house, where James and Dolly added their 1797 addition, you see Dolly's flare coming out in a distemper paint, which is sort of a peach color on the walls. And it was quite fashionable at the time.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, and we're on a visit to Montpelier, James Madison's Montpelier, the home of the father of our Constitution. Now, I've been talking to John Jeans, and he is the director of facilities and renovation there, and of restoration at Montpelier. And I hate to interrupt him because there's a lot more that John and I spoke about, and I'm promising you I will get back to him during a later episode, which we'll also devote to Montpelier. But for the moment, I think it's important for us to get outside a little bit. We've been stuck inside the mansion for the last few minutes. So when we come back from our break, I'll be speaking to an archaeologist.
Our house in the middle of our street. Our house in the middle of our house, it has a crowd. There's always something happening, and it's usually quite loud. Our mum, she's so house proud. Nothing ever slows her down, and a mess is not allowed. Our house.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm visiting Montpelier, the home of James Madison, the father of our Constitution. We've talked to several people who keep Montpelier running every day, but now it's time to get outside, to get a little bit muddy, and talk to Matthew Reeves, the director of archaeology.
My name is Matthew Reeves. I'm director of archaeology here at James Madison's Montpelier.
And you have a PhD.
Yeah, my doctorate is in archaeology, historical archaeology, and did my field work down in Jamaica looking at early 19th century slave settlements.
Very interesting stuff. Now, most listeners, when they think of archaeology, they will think either of ancient Greece, ancient Rome, or perhaps even dinosaurs. So what is there for an archaeologist to do at a place like Montpelier?
All kinds of things. It's Montpelier is an incredible place in terms of, you know, the mansion being preserved. We've just restored it back to the Madison era, to the retirement years, the 1820s. But almost all of the plantation landscape, what you see, you know, out there on the landscape today, there's no remnants of that plantation landscape out there. You see fields, you see woods, but back in Madison's day, there would have been working agricultural fields, there would have been slave quarters, there would have been fence lines, roads. All that is gone, but here at Montpelier, the archaeological remains are incredibly well preserved on the landscape. And what we're fortunate for is the Montpelier property was bought by the DuPont family in 1901. And as the DuPonts, they owned it for 83 years and then gave it to the National Trust for Historic Preservation. And as the DuPont family, they bought it as a country estate. They didn't need to farm the land. They didn't need to plow the fields. They didn't need to cut the forest using commercial timbering at the time. So all throughout the 20th century, all the 19th century and 18th century sites essentially remained untouched. Fields returned to forests, areas that on most, you know, Virginia sites would have been plowed up to, because with mechanized plowing, you could plow worn out fields and rejuvenate them in a way that you couldn't do with a horse-drawn plow. None of that happened at Montpelier. So when the trust got the property and we started doing surveys, what we started finding is site after site, slave quarters, work areas that were completely untouched, unplowed. And so we would be able to find features at these sites, that on most sites that are plowed, where you have the first foot of soil is turned up, that are incredibly well preserved, such as at-grade hearths, paths, yard surfaces, architectural items such as chimney bases, pier footings for structures. So we're able to get to a level of detail with the archaeology here that a lot of sites you're not able to. And what that's allowing us to do is to begin to piece together what this place looked like when the Madisons were here, you know, where the slave quarters were, what kind of structures were used, what kind of household items the slaves who lived there owned, what kind of, how they set up their yards.
And okay, now before we get into detail, let's put this in a little bit of chronological order. Now, the Madisons lived here starting, I think, in 1757, right?
They actually patented the land in the 1720s.
Excuse me, 1720s.
And then they moved here in 1732 from the Tidewater.
So I don't know where I got 1757. That was just stuck in my mind. Okay.
Yeah, not sure where that came from.
I'm not sure. So. I do that from time to time.
Might be a significant year, but not for here.
Not for here. So from the 1720s, the Madisons lived here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they continued to live here until Dolly Madison sold the estate in
1844.
And then mm-hmm. there were a series of 19th century owners.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then the DuPonts purchased the property in 1901 and mm-hmm. kept it for most of the 20th century.
Yeah.
And so when we're talking about archaeology, we're mostly talking about going back and looking at what happened during the Madisonian period. Is that correct?
Yes and no. I mean, for our, what we're looking at for restoring home, you know, both the house and the landscape, you know, in the visitor area, we're looking at the early 19th century record, you know, seeing where slave quarters were, where fence lines were, what the formal landscape looked like at the mansion, how the Madisons were framing the mansion within, you know, this picturesque landscape, how that intersects with the plantation. But then what the DuPonts gave the trust was 2,700 acres of land. So
that is such a blessing, because I was just, as we were sitting in your office here, and incidentally, I've got to say, it is a classic archaeologist's office. I'm sitting in this room with you, and you have a PhD, and yet you're not wearing a coat and tie. You've got your mud boots sitting here with us, and you've got a big map on the wall of Madisonia, of the state, Montpelier. And when I looked at the map of the estate, I could
see... Well, fortunately, you can't see the mess.
Okay, well,
this is a radio, so you can't see the piles of paper.
This is all ordered. I can tell. There's an order to all of this. At any rate, the map shows how wonderfully surrounded by mm-hmm. property the Montpelier Mansion and the other buildings are. And so you really have a sense when you're here that you've stepped back in time. Now, it could be stepping back to the 18th century if you're at the mansion. It could be a little more recent when you're in the buildings we're mm-hmm. in now, which were mm-hmm. part of the DuPont era. But it's definitely stepping back in time. And I had the pleasure of staying here last night in one of the DuPont era guest houses.
Mm-hmm.
It was as silent as an Egyptian tomb. It was so nice to be out here in the countryside.
Although, if you went out and saw the stars as well.
I did not last night, but I will. Are you strictly interested in what happened with the Madisons, or are you interested in subsequent archaeology as well, from subsequent periods?
Well, we're actually interested in archaeology that's taken place after the Madisons more than before. Because
really?
Before the Madisons, there was there was no historic settlement here. For prehistoric times, there was a few scattered hunting camps here at Montpelier, but no concentrations of Native Americans. We've got a few sites that we're protecting. But in terms of the historic period, what is as interesting as the Madison period is the post-Madison era. The post-Madison era, we've got a number of sites here that span from the 1840s up until the Civil War. These are late antebellum slave quarters. And what happens here during the Civil War is during the winter of 1863 and 1864, there's the Confederate Army of Northern Virginia occupies Orange County. And during that winter, Lee positions his troops basically from here all the way to Fredericksburg.
Uh-huh.
And so there are massive encampments, winter encampments here.
Now, did General Lee actually take over Montpelier as his headquarters, the mansion? Did he actually?
No, it was a friendly occupation.
Okay, so the Madison family, or excuse me, their successors.
Yeah, the Carsons
were allowed to stay there, but they came in and were sort of hosted then.
Yeah, they hosted the soldiers in terms of allowing their land, whether it was, you know, allowing or it was just determined that the troops would camp here. Probably mm-hmm. more just determined the troops would camp here.
Mm-hmm.
But we've got about a dozen regimental camps here on the property. And the regiment consists of about 350 men. You're looking at
about a dozen encampments of 300 plus men.
Yeah, and these were
not major.
It was huge. Yeah, it was an occupation, and of course, what you can imagine happened with this is you got the Union Army just on the other side of the Rapidan River in Culpeper County, and what we're finding in our surveys is we're finding these late antebellum slave quarters that are occupied up until the Civil War, and then they have a Civil War component, meaning we're finding Confederate Civil War items, mostly cavalry items, and then they're not occupied anymore. So what we're thinking is when this Confederate troop occupation occurs, that's probably when a lot of the slaves leave. They might become contraband and head to Union lines to the north. There might have been so much disruption that the slaves, you know, ran away, or the Confederate soldiers, you know, remove them from the slave quarters to use those for, you know, detachment positions for these cavalry troops.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to say, but it's what we've got with these late antebellum slave quarters, also with the Civil War camps, is a way to talk about, you know, the what happens with slavery here at Montpelier in Virginia in the U.S. And then what we've also...
May I interrupt you, please,
yeah.
Matt? I am so pleased to see not just you, but a number of other historic sites emphasize now and give proper focus to the slave issue. Because that, I emphasize to my students in constitutional law, is the great contradiction of our constitutional history.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. We start with the soaring rhetoric of the Declaration of Independence, all men are created equal, etc. We talk about all sorts of highfalutin concepts throughout our constitutional history, and yet mm-hmm. the great hypocrisy and the great contradiction was slavery. And Madison himself embodied that contradiction, as did Jefferson, as mm-hmm. did George mm-hmm. Washington, you know, the Southern slave owners. They embodied that contradiction, and so it's appropriate that the Civil War history happened here as well, because the Civil War, of course, was how that was ultimately resolved.
Oh, I think it's beautiful, because not only do we have these sites, but just like you're saying, you know, one of Madison, you know, Madison's contribution with the Constitution, you know, what he's best known for.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's also, you know, the whole balance that he tried to fix with Jefferson of state versus federal power.
Oh, big issue
and
as well, yeah.
He switched quite rapidly from being a federalist to being a Democrat-Republican, which
right.
is leaning more towards state power.
Let me put
and
that in context.
That?
I've discussed this with other people in other interviews, but let's put it in context. When you say Federalist, you're talking, some people would say Nationalist, somebody who focuses mm-hmm. on national power. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, Madison was the one who came up with the basic structure of our Constitution, and that created a supreme national government. And so that was probably his most ardent nationalist phase. But then...
Yeah.
Then Jefferson came back from Europe, and I sometimes wonder whether they just had a conversation where Jefferson took him aside and said, "What did you do?"
Yeah, yeah. Well, especially as being slave owners.
Oh, yes.
Because they realized, oh my goodness, if this is, we're making decisions on a national scale, and we have these regional interests, and we are slave owners
right.
with very much Virginia interests, how does this, I mean, it bore out. There's no way, I mean, Madison couldn't free his slaves, especially in his later years, because of the debts he had. I think if he had tried
to... He and Jefferson
to,
both, yeah.
The debtors would have been pounding his door down, because those were his, you know, the most valuable assets on his property were human property.
And I don't think that people understand that. I mean, they think you mm-hmm. own all this land, and that's your wealth. Well, it's part of your wealth, but the greater wealth was this enormous workforce that
yeah.
you had enslaved,
mm-hmm.
and they got themselves, Jefferson... Madison, not Washington to the same extent, but to some extent, they're dependent on this model. And
mm-hmm.
so even if their better angels are telling them that they need to end this practice, they can't.
Yeah. And they had a convenient, whether it's a rhetoric, a belief, or, you know, how firmly it was ingrained. But, you know, we the people wasn't, as you know, wasn't everybody.
No.
It was we, the white men in this room, who are property owners.
It was people
violence,
like it was people
which
like
is still
you,
a revolutionary
you and
concept.
Me. Right. It
mm-hmm.
is. I mean, it was
mm-hmm.
people like, you know, we're both, if I may characterize you as being, you know, middle-aged white men.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I'm guessing you own some property somewhere.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so, and I do too. And so we were the sorts of people who could vote.
Yeah.
We were the sorts of people. And people don't understand that. It was not an inclusive term when it
mm-hmm.
was coined. And that's extremely important. But I've interrupted you with all this historical stuff, and I wanted to Just put it a little bit in context, but you're saying you're actually digging up this stuff, and so you're finding the Madisonian history, but then you're finding the history of the Civil War afterward, which was just a continuation of that.
It was. And what we're looking at with we're doing a three-year project funded by NEH, National Endowment for the Humanities, looking at three different sets of slave quarters here at Montpelier that were occupied during the Madison retirement years. This is the 18-teens through the 1830s. And what we're looking at is how life was different for different groups of slaves on the plantation, field slaves, house slaves, skilled artisans. But what we'd love to do is continue this research process in through the 19th century to see how the lifestyles, the amount of choices that slaves had changes through time. And we continue this process through the post-emancipation period. We've got the Gilmore Farm, which is a log home that was built by a former slave of James Madison after he, George Gilmore, was freed after 1863-1864, with the Civil War. And it's occupied. What's neat about this structure is the original home, from the archaeology we've done, turns out to have been not that log structure that's out there today, but probably the remnants of Confederate huts that were rebuilt into a smaller structure. The Gilmores lived in that structure for the first 5 to 6 years of being on that property. And then after they obtained enough money to obtain the building materials, they built the log structure that's there today. So in the Gilmore family, you've got, embodied in that site, you've got an individual, George Gilmore, who is a former slave of James Madison, born in 1810. Probably more than likely knew Mr. Madison, was sold when either at some point during the 1830s or probably definitely sold in 1844 with the sale of Montpelier, remained in the area, was freed with the Civil War. He lives until 1901. And
he lived all the way until the DuPonts.
He lived up until 1905.
Really?
So he probably at some point met William and Annie DuPont.
Huh.
And of course he's freed. He's experienced his life as a bondsman, as a slave, and then as a freed person. But of course he doesn't enjoy what's promised by the 14th and 15th Amendments, citizenship and voting.
And those were enacted right after the Civil War.
They were enacted right after the Civil War. Might have enjoyed that for a brief period during the Reconstruction era, but then by the early 1880s, you've got Jim Crow that locks down in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And where the ideals of citizenship is put into the hands of the state in Virginia decides that citizenship isn't going to be enjoyed by people of all colors. It's only going to be enjoyed by white folk.
Right.
And that's all we have time for on our visit to Montpelier, James Madison's Montpelier, the home of the father of our Constitution. But don't fear, I'm going back many a time. In fact, I've got lots of reason to go back because, our quiz lady, Kelly Carmichael, she works at James Madison's Montpelier. She works for a special part of it called the Center for the Constitution. And I suspect I'll be making my way back to Orange, Virginia. But in the meantime, don't let that hold you back. If you find yourself over near the Piedmont, then head on over to Montpelier, visit it on your own. But if you can't do it, keep listening. We're going back. I'd like to thank our three guests today. I'd like to thank Tom Chapman, the Executive Projects Manager at Montpelier. I'd like to thank also John Jeans, who is the Restoration Director at Montpelier, and Matthew Reeves, the Director of Archaeology. Our Executive Producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.
Our house is a very, very, very fine house with two cats in. Life used to be so hard.